Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad when you're here with us. And if you'd like to join our conversations, you're more than welcome to do so. Our phone numbers for contact, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782, or shoot us an email. Those go to jx@jeffnet.org. The sense of adventure that some people attach to eating appears to be growing. Today's guest certainly comes with a lot of evidence pointing to a trend. Those of us who might consider a different sauce with a traditional meal are not on the cutting edge. That edge is occupied by people who will define the term food itself very broadly. And we meet a bunch of those people in the book, Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Dana Goodyear is the author. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and teaches at the University of Southern California, and she's our guest on The Exchange today. Dana, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Good to have you here. What was the starting point for this book? What nudged you into action?
Well, I wanted to write this book because I noticed that going out to dinner had become, rather than, you know, what it always had been, an indulgence, you know, an encounter with your favorite comfort food, suddenly I noticed that at the very high end of American dining, food was being presented as a challenge to the idea of what is edible. So there's this major revision underway, and then I trace the origins of that to, you know, very sort of, you know, the low end, the what's happening in the little strip mall restaurants in our part of the country.
So the challenge that you talk about, I mean, how is that presented at the table, for example?
Well, I think when you are given a dish with live ants on it that is served to you by one of the greatest chefs in the world, and it, as part of a tasting menu that costs about $300, I mean, that's a real challenge. Americans, we don't think of insects as food, but 80% of the world does and really enjoys them, and there's an opening up that's happening, and American and Western diners are starting to look at more resourceful cultures and their ways of eating and take some cues there.
I'm glad you added those qualifiers. I have had dishes that included ants, but not deliberately.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I talked to an entomologist who said that, in his opinion, there is no doubt that if in Europe there had been insects the size of pigs, we would all be eating insects now. So for us, it was a matter of efficiency, and European culture had other options for protein. And now I think what's happening is that a lot of European and European-derived cultures are seeing that we've pushed that kind of agriculture, that kind of animal agriculture, to its limits. And with intense, just take pig farming, and the intensity of that farming practice is really unsustainable. And so we're starting to look at some of the unexplored aspects of of potential ingredients, and that means that we are looking at cultures that have been practicing a kind of necessity eating for quite a long time, and we've been, in our prosperity eating, we have been ignoring those ways of eating.
We'll get further into insects later on. I know we had the author of the Eat a Bug cookbook on a while back, and that was a lot of fun.
You?
We did indeed.
Yeah, I know him.
Okay. But you say, though, for yourself, though, my relationship to food is that of an acrophobe to a bridge. What do you mean there?
Well, I mean that there's a push and a pull, and I bet a lot of people feel this way. It's exciting to think about eating something that's new to you, and it can be, you know, thrilling, and it can raise the goosebumps on your arms, and it can be something you want to step back from at the same time. So this is what I think is going on in the food movement now, is that so many diners are having this experience of, I want to attend. You know, everybody's talking about it. It sounds really interesting, but I'm a little bit scared. And I wanted to explore that feeling and that impulse and try to understand why we're being presented with those kinds of foods now.
You got us thinking about some of the very terms that are being used at the moment. For example, why are there foodies? Why don't the older terms like gourmand work?
Well, those words are not, first of all, they're not in English. Foodie is a word that rubs a lot of people the wrong way, but the great thing about it is that it's a word that reflects, it was coined by an American food writer in the 80s. It reflects the American moment of interest in food, and it does that rather perfectly, I think. It's, you know, with that diminutive, the IE on the end, mm-hmm. it suggests something about the youth of the movement, both in terms of, you know, American culinary history, that we're really sort of in our adolescent period still, but also the youthful age of a lot of people who describe themselves as foodies. This is not a movement of, you know, middle-aged fat cats. It's a movement of young people and from all over the demographic spectrum. I mean, so it's driven by that group anyway, the sort of 18 to 35-year-old group. And so I think that the cuteness of it works and the youthfulness of it works and the Americanness of it works.
I never thought of it in those terms, though, sort of like Trekker and Trekkie, that, you know,
yeah,
fooders
exactly.
And foodies or something. But tell us about this dinner party that you write about, hosted by a former L.A. County health inspector. This is kind of a riot.
Well, this guy is a fascinating person because he's hyper aware, because of his professional work, of the risks involved with experimental eating, and yet he can't help himself. He's totally fascinated. And so he put together this dinner where everything was supposed to, the diners essentially pledged to have no psychological, medical, or aesthetic barriers to what they could eat. I mean, it was a sort of a ludicrous submission on the part of the diners, but I thought that it said something about what's being demanded of diners now in certain contexts, you know, these willing guinea pigs. And everything at the dinner was meant to be a real challenge. So there was live octopus, and there was wheat lakote, which is a kind of corn smut, and there was beer made out of birds, you know, brewed with bird's nests and other items from the Chinese apothecary, deer tendons, and
all kinds of things. Okay, well, let me get to the rest of the list when we come back from a break. Dana Goodyear's our guest. Her book is Anything That Moves. We can take your phone calls and emails as well. We'll come back and talk with Dana and you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is New Yorker staff writer Dana Goodyear. She also teaches at the University of Southern California, and she's written a book about the emerging food culture in America called Anything That Moves. And yes, it is about people who will eat, in a lot of cases, anything that moves, sometimes is still moving. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 if you have questions or some comments about some gastronomic adventures of your own. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to finish up the thought about this meal served by the former L.A. County health inspector, where he said people could have physical... emotional or aesthetic barriers,
psychological, yes. Medical. There could basically be no limit to what they were willing to consume.
Uh huh. And so, you attended this party, I'm guessing?
I did. And what really was so interesting about it was how normal the other diners were. I mean, you would sort of think it would be the weirdest of the weird willing to sign up for this. And in fact, it was what stood as remarkable to me was how ordinary these people were. And this is it just proved to me that this has really become a mainstream movement. And it's also got intellectual underpinnings. This is a group of people that, even though they're excited for a thrilling food adventure, there's a sense of anxiety about the future that underlies these food adventures, in the sense that as Americans, we've got to start thinking outside of our meat and potatoes a little bit here.
So it's something more than the old Saturday Night Live joke about Scottish cuisine being based on a dare. It's more than a dare. There really is an environmental ethic and a sense of what you referred to already as necessity eating involved here.
There is. I think sometimes that gets lost in the sort of surface aspects of it, which can seem very macho or very almost gluttonous sometimes. But I think, to me, the more interesting and significant and lasting part of it is this drive behind it comes out of a concern with the way we have been eating and a desire to change that.
All right, so there are three sections to the book: Squishy or Swank, Down the Rabbit Hole, and Discomfort Food. Can you give us just a little thumbnail sketch of each of those sections?
Well,
Squishy, I can guess. What's the swank part?
The swank part is these these tasting menus that are very, you know, just incredibly elaborate and often quite expensive and sometimes served in very unofficial contexts, you know, the underground dinner. I think it's probably a big thing up where you guys are, too. And the idea is that at this sort of leading edge of the food movement, which, you know, is sort of for the most elite diners in the world, there are ideas being presented in that context that are very much out of poverty eating, necessity eating. They really are not ways that Americans have ever been comfortable eating. We have had an idea that, you know, we're so advanced and civilized, and that's why we only eat the skeletal muscle of animals. And in fact, the people who are pushing the culture forward are saying we need to eat lower on the animal, deeper in the animal, lower on the food chain. You know, the idea of foraging, the sort of survivalist aspect of these foods, that, you know, a little bit of bark and lichen and an insect, and that's your $200 meal.
Wow. If that does happen, a bark and lichen and an insect is a $200 meal.
I've reduced it a little bit, okay, to make a point, but you know, in the course of a 10-course meal, you might get any one of those or all of them.
All right, so there's a chapter here on in the Squishy or Swank section on Jonathan Gold, the scavenger.
And you
had a piece on him in the New Yorker, didn't you? I seem to remember this.
Yes,
this,
exactly.
This restaurant hopping thing. Okay, yeah. But let's shorten his list. Where doesn't he eat in L.A.?
Well, he's not so interested in the anything that is trying to imitate a European model of dining. I mean, this is the advantage that L.A. has. It's never been considered a great food town, and it's so far away from Europe, and that kind of food has never really worked here. And what he has pointed out is the incredible diversity and just aesthetic pleasure to be had by seeking out little restaurants in, you know, little traditional restaurants in the outskirts or in the little mini malls that people just drive past in their cars and don't notice, and because they don't read the language that the sign is in, they feel it almost blurs out to them and they don't go in. So he has really been the one pointing people into these spots and saying, look, here's where you can get, you know, the only Isan Thai restaurant in the entire, you know, Western United States is here. And the and this is what you should order, and if you don't know what to order, just point. And he's opened up a lot of food to a lot of people who would otherwise never have encountered it.
Some of this stuff is too funny to believe, though. I mean, he did 27 shots of espresso in one day.
Well, he's the example. He's sort of he's the Pied Piper of the foodies. He's getting people to eat raw liver and things like that. But he's also an example, I think, of this encyclopedic eating that seems to really be a feature of foodieism, which is to say, you know, this incredible thoroughness. And of course, he's a restaurant critic, so there's some rationale for it. But what if you're just a blogger doing that, or you're? But I think he's made that kind of approach to eating part of the foodie approach.
So you've got to do like the whole gamut of this particular category in one day or something.
Yes, and it's perfect for the kind of amateur experts that define the sort of popular food movement. And this is everybody with an Instagram or Twitter or blog account.
All right. So, and where do people read Jonathan Gold's stuff, his restaurant reviews?
Well, he's sort of bounced back and forth between the LA Times and the LA Weekly for years. But the columns that won him fame and earned him a Pulitzer Prize, and he's still the only food writer who's ever gotten one, were in the LA Weekly. But now he's at the LA Times.
He guzzled hot sauce as a kid, I understand. Is it possible his taste buds are just worn out?
You know, he can taste so many things in a fiery dish that I can't, that I think the answer is no. I think he has an incredibly refined palate. I think that he has tested it against almost every edible substance on earth, and many that a lot of Americans wouldn't recognize as edible.
All right, I want to move on and talk about other people in this section on Squishy or Swank, particularly about the creation of the National Association for the Specialty Food Trade, the NASFT.
Yeah.
When did that start and why?
So this is where I explore the origins of the sort of daredevil eating or unconventional eating in America. And it turned out that they coincide with the origins of gourmet, which used to be called specialty food. So World War II, obviously, a lot of people came to this country as refugees before, during, and after World War II. And starting over, a group particularly of Jewish refugees became specialty food importers. But this had not really existed in this country before. And this group of entrepreneurs, they would go to Europe, they would go to Asia, they would go to Latin America, and they would seek out delicacies that were unfamiliar to Americans and present them as gourmet. So sometimes those were not gourmet items in other countries, because, you know, what specialty is a matter of what's familiar or what's not familiar.
So the everyday for one country is the specialty for us.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the sort of spam in the French gourmet market idea, and that does happen. Or Uncle Ben's, that's an example I heard often, that you can go to the fanciest, up until the 80s, you could go to the fanciest French department store and see Uncle Ben's presented as a delicacy. But this group really took great risks, and there were a bunch of really fascinating swashbuckling characters who introduced, alongside caviar and foie gras and French cheese, they introduced barbecued baby bees and Bengal tiger meat, and, you know, in those days Hawaiian punch was considered exotic, and and marinated artichokes and baby corn. So it's really interesting to see this specialty food industry in its infancy, and the way in which sort of these titillating, unfamiliar foods played into it from the very beginning.
Dana Goodyear is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, New Yorker staff writer, teacher at the University of Southern California, author of Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. You can swap food stories with us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The history lesson on getting what were then called specialty foods into America is really useful, because it makes us realize that there were things that our ancestors thought were icky, and yeah, I would never eat something like that. So the things that we say about that today could end up being the stuff our kids take for granted.
Well, that's true, and I do think that this group of young, you know, this sort of younger demographic that I'm talking about that so fully embraces the idea of being interested in food and has really made that part of social identity, when those people raise their kids, they're going to raise them with different attitudes from the way that maybe a lot of people in my generation or older were raised. So I think there is this sense that I see this as something that will become part, it's not a blip and not a trend, but it's going to be part of American identity in a very, a much more profound way. I mean, we've been so, for the past 100 years in American culture, we've been really driving food to the margins. We don't know food producers. Food production happens in factories. It happens away from us. It's not something we do at home anymore. It's very abstract, and it has been very abstract. And a lot of this movement is about making it more literal again and bringing it back into daily life.
You use the term swashbuckler ready, which I guess is the answer to my question, which is how much salesmanship did it take in the 50s and 60s to get people to try unusual foods?
Well, that's part of my double entendre with the title, Anything That Moves, because I think there is, you know, food marketing is an enormous part of this, and how you present food, and do you call it ant eggs or do you call them escamoles, and which sounds more appetizing to you? So these salesmen really were incredibly influential, and they had a great audience, though, because, you know, it was, let's say, the 1950s. By this point, there were a lot of Americans who had been overseas during the war, who had traveled, who had been exposed to different things. There was a time of great prosperity in America. People had money to spend. They were showing off a little bit. They were moving out to the suburbs. They entertained at home, and they wanted to, you know, have those chocolate-covered ants to serve their bridge group. So there was this real, there was a drive for novelty then, and I think that has never left the specialty food category or the gourmet food category.
All right. Since we're in here talking about bugs, let's come back to the whole eat a bug cookbook and eating of insects discussion, because it was well represented in that conversation, that, and you just brought it up again, 80% of the world And pretty much everybody outside the United States has bugs in their diet at some point or another. Does that include Europe, though? I mean, is Europe also, do they get past the ick factor on bugs?
They do in certain contexts, but not generally, not as a, you know, something to see on your plate as a bug. I mean, there are European cheeses that can't be made, you know, Mimolette, or, you know, can't be made without insects that remain in the cheese. So I think that there are very specific contexts in which it's okay for Europeans, but in general, Anglo and European, you know, I'll just say Western, very broadly, culture has not been very accepting of bugs. But that's just because we don't have a culinary tradition built up around them. We don't have the recipes from our grandmother. We don't have the positive associations of, you know, your birthday cricket.
The grasshoppers so, grandma used to make. Yeah.
We have the opposite. We have, you know, people growing up with good reason being told, don't eat that, don't put a bug in your mouth. But and it is not safe to wild craft or forage for your own insects because you don't know, you know, we have a lot of pesticides in the soil and you don't know where they've been. So there, you have to make sure you're getting clean bugs the same way, you know, with any animal.
That was a real light bulb moment in the book for me, though, when you pointed out, though, that part of the reason that we use so many pesticides is because we don't want, not only don't eat bugs, we don't want bugs in our other foods.
Exactly. It is ironic. And, you know, there's been such a drive to eliminate bugs, and we think of them as pests, and we haven't appreciated them as protein sources. And, you know, what is happening now is that a vanguard of chefs is starting to say, these are protein sources.
They really are. And in fact, one of the things that we learned from the author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook was that the ratio of fat to protein is just so much better. I mean, by weight, you just get much more out of bugs, actually, than you get for much less resource put into it, you know, much less in the way of water and corn and all the other stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, if you're expecting to eat the equivalent of a 12-ounce steak, you're going to have to eat a pile of 1,000 insects. But I think that the corresponding idea that could make people more open to it is that we don't need as much protein as we've been telling ourselves we need. So we overeat protein in a pretty obscene way in this country, and that has that drive to have meat on the table every day has influenced our, you know, our environmental practices in so many negative ways. So I think that there is, even among the most meat-centric chefs that I have spent time with, there's a sense that, you know what, meat needs to move to the edge of the plate. Something else needs to be in the center.
Hmm. Interesting. I mean, it makes you stop and think about just the way we allocate land, even because of the way we eat.
Yeah.
Everything is just very, very dependent upon what we put on the plate in the first place. There's a long section in the book about food in Las Vegas, which gets into some things that are illegal, although not uniformly so, which makes the rest of us always wonder, what is the appeal of shark fin soup? It sounds like it's not particularly tasty.
Shark fin soup is a status symbol. So it is an unsustainable idea of, you know, the sort of emperor's food that has become a marker of middle class prosperity. So the the regulations in California to eliminate it have everything to do with the fact that, you know, there's a booming middle class and in Chinese culture and in China, but also in this country. I mean, that, you know, California can't influence anything but California consumption patterns, but they're just, you know, the depletion of the shark population worldwide is really tragic and has consequences for the rest of the marine ecosystem. So, you know, the way that the shark fins are gotten is pretty cruel, and it's also pretty wasteful. And because the fins are valuable, but the rest of the shark isn't, they're definned, and then the shark is left to drown, basically, or bleed out and dumped in the ocean, so that, you know, the more valuable, there's more room for the more valuable fins on board the ship. So, I mean, that's one of those cases where a broader sense of what's edible, Americans don't usually think about eating a shark fin, a broader sense of what's edible has some built-in problems there.
That is interesting, too, because the fact is the rest of the shark is eminently edible, but that is not the choice that's made when you're making shark fin soup. All right. I want to get another great life story in here. Brett Ottolenghi, you go on at length in the book. When did he begin selling truffles? He was pretty young, wasn't he?
Well, I call him the Truffle Kid because he started when he was 13 out of his dorm room. He went to a boarding school in the Northeast, and became a purveyor of Croatian truffles out of his dorm room.
I guess if you're going to sell things out of your dorm room, that's one of the good ones.
Exactly.
Let's take a break there and come back and talk more about Brett Ottolenghi. Dana Goodyear is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. We'll talk more with Dana and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join our conversation about moving the boundaries of what we eat. 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back with Dana Goodyear and you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dana Goodyear, New Yorker staff writer and a teacher at the University of Southern California, and the author of the book Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. We were just talking a moment ago about how the meat needs to move to the edge of the plate in the eyes of many chefs, and something else needs to move to the center. And we're talking about how we define that center here on the Jefferson Exchange. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So back to Brett Ottolenghi, who was selling truffles out of his dorm room when he was in prep school. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And then he went out to Las Vegas and continued selling truffles out of his dorm room at the university there, and became this figure around town who was known for showing up at the back door with a scale to weigh the truffles and a little stash of them, or walking through the lobby of these elaborate casino hotels carrying the hindquarters of a pig with the hoof still on. So he definitely is one of the sort of millennial generation foodies who he grew up watching Anthony Bourdain and Andrew Zimmern on TV. And this is this idea of eating more broadly is something that he has, sort of inculcated from childhood with. And so what he does is he goes around the world and sources ingredients to be used by the chefs in Las Vegas. And Las Vegas' food culture, as we know, has transformed from the 90s, when it was still a kind of surf and turf buffet land, to a very, very rich and eclectic and highbrow food culture.
Gotten on the leading edge of things then, and instead of back in the meat and potatoes land.
Yeah, a lot of chefs who don't have another presence in the United States will have their restaurant there, and it's, got more Michelin stars than you can count. It's definitely become a food destination, even as it's still, probably best known for other things. But a lot of people go there just to eat now.
Wow. Let us take a call. We have Mark in Reading on the line. If the button will push, there we go. Mark in Reading, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Goodyear, the author of Anything That Moves.
Thank you. Yes, I can remember in the early 1970s hearing about some scientists who had decided that they would be able to feed the world if only they could get people to eat maggots. They knew there was a ick factor there, but that was their theory, was that there was pure protein, really good stuff.
All right. Did you ever embrace that yourself, Mark?
No, I can't say that I have. All I have commented over the years that, like the people in Canton are purported to do, I'm perfectly willing to eat anything with legs except the table.
Right.
My uncle informed me that included cockroaches. I said, hey, I could do it.
All right. Well, good
fried,
for you.
Fried or whatever might work.
Got to be prepared, though. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for that,
great.
Mark.
Frying is a great strategy. Those people, the scientists that Mark was talking about, they are still around, and they're, the people who were there, graduate students are still around, and they are rejoicing in this moment where it seems that all of a sudden, when they're least expecting it, chefs who are such icons in our culture now have started to talk about insect eating. So there's a sense of optimism in that same group of people now. And I think nobody says maggots anymore because that word does not sound that appealing.
It probably sounds better in French, right?
Exactly. But they are really excited about the evidence that chefs are willing to look at sort of some Chinese recipes and Mexican presentations and get Americans to think that that might be a cool thing to do.
So, Dana, is there a gateway bug? Is there one that chefs will prepare ahead of all others? It seems like grasshoppers were the specialty in the Eat a Bug cookbook.
I think grasshoppers are pretty easy because they're, you know, deep fried, bar snack. It's not, you know, I think spiders are at the very, there's nothing scary about a grasshopper when you encounter it. Whereas I think, you know, I've eaten a lot of insects now, but I don't think I could eat a spider. I still can't do it. I'm actually kind of scared of spiders. So but I've never met anyone who's afraid of, grasshoppers or crickets. So I think that is a good entry point.
That answers the question about the things that you wouldn't eat. But what are some of the other things that you've run across about that made you go, oh, boy, and maybe even stop short?
Well, one of the hardest for me was the balut, which is the Filipino delicacy that's an unhatched chick cooked in its egg and eaten whole. And what was so interesting about that experience is that it was not the flavor that was difficult for me because it really tasted very familiar. I mean, it's a sort of chicken soup or dark meat on a chicken itself, but it was just the knowledge of what I was eating and eating, you know, whole animal eating like that, where you really are eating it all at once. That was an extreme for me, and that was really hard to get through. But you know, there are other things that sound so appalling that I actually found really tasty, and I almost hate to admit it, but there's this coffee called Kopi Luwak, which
I know the story here. Yes.
Yeah, it's made from the beans are collected from the droppings of Sumatran civet, a wild civet, which is like a cat. And what interested me about it is that this seems like the universal definition of inedible, which is it's previously been digested by another animal. This is something that you don't encounter except in starvation circumstances. And this is Donner Party stuff. And yet this coffee is sold at times for, it's so rare, it's sold for $1,000 a pound. And you think, who on earth would want it? Well, it's $1,000 a pound. The cup of coffee I had was $90, and it is actually a really delicious coffee. But I mean, no cup of coffee is worth $90. But I sort of had to try it. It was this really stark convergence of the highbrow and the lowbrow that I think exemplifies a lot of the foodie food.
Well, I'm glad to hear from you. You're the first person I've talked to who actually drank the stuff. I've been hearing the story for years about Kopi Luwak and where it comes from. And basically, the cats poop out the beans. They're picked up, cleaned off, and roasted.
Yes.
Well, but it sounds like a great cup of coffee.
It tastes like, it's very caramelly. It sort of tastes like that burnt, you know, if you make an apple pie and it's sort of like where it bubbles over at the edges and is a little bit, but that burnt caramel flavor, that's pretty much the flavor of it.
Wow, that sounds impressive. Let's take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking food with Dana Goodyear, the author of Anything That Moves.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Dana.
Hi.
Okay, well, it is kind of all over the place right now, but let's see if I can sort out my thoughts here, as random as they are. As I told the screener, Reed, I was going to say, people who are vegetarians and vegans, they think they're trying to do this for ethical reasons, and I say not so, because those poor plants, when they see you coming, they just can't run away. So, yeah, I'm trying to be whimsical about this because of all the grimness. And let's see. Let's look to the future, shall we? Let's see what the future foodie will be like in the middle of the century. My thoughts go to Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where the sect is eating these beetles while they're still alive, and there's Star Trek Next Generation, where the commander's captured by the Klingons, and the Klingons, their idea of a good meal is that they have to fight the meal in order to consume it, because it's still alive on their plates. And let's see, Dana, well, what do you think about this for a future scenario? You have a nice pot of algae bubbling in your kitchen somewhere, and you have a nice pot of liquid nitrogen in order to process it, and... Yeah, so Dana, what's the future of a foodie in the middle of this century? And I'll take the answer off the air if I could, Jeffrey.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Good to hear from you.
Well, I think that what we're going to see, you know, I could make predictions about, well, more people will be eating insects, organ meat will be normal again. I think that those things are both true, but I think really what I feel most of all is that being interested in food and making it part of your daily life and part of your experience and your social life and your entertainment, that will be part of the American identity in a way that it hasn't been for a long time.
Instead of something we just grab on the way to doing something else?
Exactly.
Got it. Let's take another call. Here's Randy in Rouche. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dana Goodyear.
Good morning. This is an interesting topic. It reminded me of some friends of mine that had a lot of interest in cultural food from Japan, and a lot of what we would consider to be byproducts from seafood, I guess, is pretty sought after delicacies in a lot of different cultures. But what they did was they were food people. They were in the food import business and just generally had a lot of interest in food from all over the world. But they took this idea of kind of reconstituting different kinds of what we would consider to be kind of trash fish here in North America and reconstituted it into the fake crab meat that hit the market mm-hmm. back in the, oh, I don't know, I guess they, you know, when I met these folks, they were hauling this stuff around in cooler chests trying to create a market for it, and when they finally sold the business, I think they sold it for around $100 million. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of money in crazy food ideas, I guess, but, you know, the idea of reconstituting, you know, byproducts and creating things that would otherwise be not very palatable to a lot of North Americans was interesting, and your topic just reminded me of all of that. So I just wanted to share that story.
All right. Thanks for that, Randy.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
It makes me think about, you know, the idea of trash fish and what we consider edible fish or inedible fish. And you think about something like calamari, which is now, you know, American and super mainstream, and that was bait not that long ago. And a marine ecologist I talked to was really, really interesting. He said, you know, we think we have this idea of that we have food preferences. Our preferences are really, really shaped to an extent that we don't acknowledge by what's available. And that's kind of a governing idea of the book for me is that we're starting to eat these things and call them delicious. And we have found ways, there are people finding ways of making them delicious, but sort of connected to the idea of what we can get now and what we think we might be able to get in the future, because there's a this sense of, you know, the factory farm model being really unsustainable, whether you're talking about for plant agriculture or animal agriculture.
You do write in the book about the different ends of the food culture, from the carts in Los Angeles to the restaurants in Las Vegas. Is there an income gap or a gap there too? I mean, as there is in the rest of society right now, that seems to be growing, where you get really, really high end foods for people who can afford to buy it, and the stuff that we used to consider for our plates is being consumed at the low end too.
I think what's happening in terms of the business model is that you see the gourmetization, if I can say that, of the low end. So there's an exaltation of the little mom and pop Vietnamese restaurant, and the food truck has become something that you know, chefs who've decided, you know what, my last restaurant was a $5 million build out and I had a bunch of investors and I had to do everything that they said and I had to have 25 entrees to make my monthly number. I'm gonna do a food truck, and I'm gonna serve exactly what I want to serve, and make a business out of it. So you see this sort of, that has a lot to do with the recession, of course. The idea that, you know, the restaurant has been kind of released from its formal setting, the very expensive mm-hmm. four walls of the restaurant. And fine dining is becoming something that you can find, you know, from a food truck. And people are also deciding, you know, influenced by leaders like Jonathan Gold, they're being saying fine dining is something that happens in a little teeny restaurant that nobody's ever heard of in the far reaches of the county.
So it's not just about pushing the boundaries of what goes on the plate. It's pushing the boundaries of the whole ball of wax, basically.
Exactly.
How it's served, where it's served, by whom it's served.
Exactly. Huh. And what it is and what's being served.
Mm-hmm. Quickly before we go, because I want to make sure, there's a lot of interest in raw milk in our region and another bunch of cases in Oregon. I want to get to the experience with the Rawsome folks in L.A. What is the first, let me get from the Rawsome side then, the people who ran this underground dairy, why do they favor the raw milk product so much?
Well, there are a couple of reasons, and I think the biggest one is that it's considered a health food by this community, and it has properties that they can't find in pasteurized milk, and a lot of people have found it transformative on their health and on their children's health. So, in a good way, and the government's fear is that it would be transformative in a negative and irreversible way on people's health. So that's what the conflict is about. And then there's this idea that, well, if I acknowledge the risks and I want to do it, why can't I do it? And so this is how this very passionate food community is butting heads with the regulatory system.
Well, there's a whole bunch of the book we didn't even touch upon. It's called Anything That Moves, Renegade Chefs, Fearless Eaters, and the Making of a New American Food Culture. Dana Goodyear wrote it. She's been our guest. Dana, thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye. Tomorrow on The Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about Oregon's worst charities. At 8:30, we'll talk about millennials who are volunteering in Oregon. They're among the top volunteers in Oregon. And then we'll get to meet somebody who's one of the appraisers from the Antiques Roadshow at 9 o'clock tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant and manning the controls today, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow at 8 for another live edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.